Hey there, welcome to Sauce and Bun Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Dana, head of growth at Sauce Group, serial acquirer buying wonderful sauce businesses to take them to the next level. And here I chat with inspiring founders and experts to get an inside scoop on how they made their business success. And today with me is Emil, founder of Jitsi, a set of open source projects allowing you to create video conferencing solutions that are secure and scalable, but it's also a bunch of APIs, SDKs to power your existing solutions, and it's a community. So it's a bunch of stuff.
It is. Everything that has to do with our life, we somehow end up calling it Jitsi one way or another.
Okay, that's a good start. All right, but you know, before we get to Jitsi and then, you know, what it is, how you built it, and how it ended up being the video conference app that Edward Snowden, if I'm not mistaken, once recommended, let's get to your background. Like, how did you get to build what you've built in the first place?
All right. Hopefully this isn't going to be too boring. I was born in Bulgaria. Ever since I was a kid, I was fascinated by the idea of talking remotely. I remember having our first pair of walkie-talkies with my brother, and we would just play for hours. I just thought it was so awesome. I remember he was going to the shop, and we would give one of our walkie-talkies to my mom, and then we would ask, should we buy this? And then we'd come back, should we buy this? And just to be able to ask her stuff remotely. Started my studies in Sofia, but then quickly, year three, moved to France. When I entered my master's in France, they were all about doing things around IPv6. That was the new version of the internet protocol. It was quite hypey. It's still struggling to see full, complete adoption, but it's made some progress. So anyway, back then, this was a new thing. And the research team, the network research team at the Strasbourg University in France was working on trying to figure out how the different apps would work on IPv6 and would there be any issues that need resolving. So I suggested, well, I'm all about remote communications. How about I write a small thing that can communicate over IPv6? This is how Jitsi was born. It was an audio video phone. In 2 weeks, actually, it was an audio video phone that was capable of doing a rudimentary call over IPv6. Back then with MSN. So I remember going back to my thesis advisor and just telling him, yeah, it can do a video call. It's 80% done. So I suppose for the past 25 years, we've been working on the remaining 20%. The first 80% got done in 2 weeks. So then I ended up continuing using that as a research tool for validating my PhD work. And I remember that during that time, I was originally very excited about the idea of doing research. But then after working on article after article, you know, you come up with one optimization, something that you think is a good idea. You go and you implement it and you put a bunch of nights and days into it and you publish and that's it. Nothing happens. And if you're lucky, maybe a few people would pick up what you've written and cite it in their papers. But for a generally decent article, if it gets cited 20, 30 times, that's a good average. So for 20, 30 people to just say, by the way, Emil did this, that's the extent of your impact. It felt very depressing. Just all this work serving seemingly no one really depressed me. And so back then I thought, this academia is not for me. I wouldn't be able to live like that. I remember walking the streets back then and just seeing, for example, a soldier or a policeman and thinking, oh man, I envy you because at least you know what purpose you serve in society. What is it that I'm here for other than spending government money? And it didn't feel nice. So that's when I decided to start a business activity around the Jitsi project. A few people were using it and it felt like there were need for development services around it. I started a company together with Yana. She's the co-founder of the Blue Gym company that was servicing Jitsi. We later got married and now we have a family and children. Back then we were just business partners. But with that, the longer story of Jitsi started. That's the thing that made it ultimately sustainable and survivable. And that was an interesting journey. It was exactly the opposite of everything that a startup is supposed to be from the prism of the, you know, from the Silicon Valley prism. When you create a startup here, you're supposed to, it's very rationalistic. Here's this problem. Here's my solution to the problem. Here's how many people have the problem. Here's how much I think it's worth to them for that problem to be solved. Here's how much it's going to cost me to solve the problem. Here's how much money we're going to make. So people want the whole, I know we touched a lot about predictability, but people want a lot of predictability here. Now, so they want to know how much they're going to make out of their investment. Obviously, everyone knows, people aren't stupid, but everyone knows that these predictions are not, you know, probably the most likely thing to not happen when you do a business plan. That's like probably, yeah, I'm pretty sure that business plan isn't going to happen. And yet, everyone wants you to have that. Now, the downside of this approach is that, I should start with the upside. The upside of doing a startup that way is that it can foster a lot of support. It can excite people. You have a vision. The vision can unite people. It can get you support, which you need, so you can get very substantial sums of money to develop whatever it is that you were trying to do. The downside is that if you miss it by a substantial amount, you don't have too many opportunities to pivot away and try something else. It's, you know, maybe you do it once. We didn't manage this time. Let's try to sell to a different market. Let's try enterprises and not consumers. That's usually what happens. But then you do that once and twice, and then you're done. Sorry, Emil, no more money for you. Go and try something else. And that idea is dead. Now, to the credit of the local ecosystem, this doesn't go as a black stamp on your passport, the fact that it didn't work. On the contrary, this is considered experience. You knew how to manage the process. You know how to talk to investors. You know how to rally support. All of this is great. But there's a core of work that you put into that idea that I believe has worth, has value, and it has to be forgotten. I think that's a pity. I'm not trying to diss the entire approach too much, because obviously the results are out there. A bunch of innovation has come up of that motto, and it's very successful. But there's also something that we're leaving on the table with all of these abandoned startups that no one wants to invest in anymore. And by the time when the money runs out, the fact that it was available at one point means that you've accumulated a bunch of personnel. There's a bunch of engineers working on it. You probably have people helping you with marketing, with design, with support. So you have this huge machine. It cannot go on its own. It cannot continue on its own. If it doesn't have the capital from VCs, it's just going to die. And most startups die. So all of this was a huge tangent to say that we did exactly the opposite. We had no investments from venture capitalists. We had a couple of local grants from government funding, and I'd be happy to talk about that later. I know we're going to talk about money and open source. We were selling development services to people who needed to use Jitsi, and it did 90% of what they needed it to do. They just needed the last 10% to be at it, and we would go and do that for them. I think that was a very good model for the sustainability of the project. We didn't live great. There was a lot of pasta for dinner during those times. But the project could go on for a very long time. And we certainly made a ton of mistakes. There's a bunch of new beginnings that we did. For example, we started originally Jitsi, as I said, was a local audio video phone that runs on your computer. We thought that we would start adding instant messaging so that it's your communicator for everything. So we added support for a bunch of instant messaging solutions. Back then, those were Jabber, AIM, ICQ, and a bunch of others. Then we did some really weird, stupid things. Like we added the ability for you to talk to a dictionary from your chat messenger, that you would send a word and it would send you back the definition of that word. We added the ability to use it as a terminal. So it's as if you're chatting with your computer. A bunch of things that felt cool to an engineer, but really served no purpose for anyone. And that was certainly mistakes. But the point that I'm trying to do is that these mistakes, we could afford to make them because we didn't have someone breathing down our necks to say, are you guys already making the revenue that you said you would be making? So ultimately, we survived long enough to finally find and implement something that was worthwhile to people. And that happened when WebRTC as a technology came along. And that's a technology that we're using right now that lets you communicate with audio and video through your browser. At that point, Jitsi already had components that were running in servers. It was no longer just the client running on your computer. And that made it very compatible and friendly to WebRTC. Some of the choices that we had made because we had to support Jitsi turned out to be very relevant to browsers as well. This component is Jitsi Video Bridge. We also went and created a website of this entire thing, and it just took off amazingly. This is when we also got approached by Atlassian, who back then were building HipChat, and they wanted a video component. So they asked us if we wanted to join. That actually happened the day that my older son was born. We had an email from Atlassian saying, hey, are you interested to talk? It was quite a day. And a few months later, we closed the deal, moved to the US with the entire team. We were back then a team of about 10 people. Everyone traveled to the US. For the first time, we were working from the same location in Austin. In Atlassian, we did some pretty good work. This is when Jitsi became essentially cloud native. Back then, 2015, 2016, this is where everyone was moving to the cloud. This is when we learned that side of the business as well. And a few years later, for various reasons, Atlassian decided that they didn't want to invest in HipChat anymore. They closed it down. The one part that survived was Jitsi because it was still such an independent piece of software that it could live without HipChat. So this is when 8x8 acquired us from Atlassian. 8x8 is a company that offers communication solutions, contact centers, and unified communications, and all that. So they too need a video component. They've acquired us, and this is still our happy home to this day. So here's a long-winded version of our history.
That's a whole story, right? And it's a hell of a story too. So thank you for walking us down the memory lane. But, you know, I have so many questions, right? So first of all, kind of noticed that, you know, you were talking about the way you were walking down the street while still doing the research for the university and kind of thinking, you know, I'm just spending the government money and then working on some government grants. And I felt like maybe that was, and correct me if I'm wrong, that was one of the reasons why you landed at the end of the day with open source, kind of with no backing up from either government or VCs. And I want to ask you about that, but also add to this the fact that, you know, you started talking about larger companies and implementing different metrics and kind of adding predictability into the mix. I started thinking about the way we acquire companies as well, and we sometimes acquire them when they don't think about predictability and don't really have the proper P&L or something. And, you know, because it's a small company, like, and, you know, the entire kind of idea is right there in front of them. And it's when they join somebody else or when they reach a certain revenue, when it becomes really relevant. So I really want to tap into that and kind of get to the point where, you know, maybe you share what you ended up tracking as a part of a bigger group. But yeah, to my previous note about, you know, kind of landing with open source, like, what was the reason?
I think you're right. So open source, I remember right before I started Jitsi, I had this internship at Alcatel, and I was just sitting at this box. Back then, it was still open spaces that were split in box, kind of like the Matrix, Mr. Anderson layout. And I was just thinking, this doesn't feel great. I wonder, in order to start a job somewhere, you have to work for a bunch of years to prove your worth and actually acquire worth. And then only then you get to maybe have something that's more fun. And that's how it seemed to me back then when I was a student. And I thought, I wonder, isn't there a shortcut around that? Isn't there a way to skip the few years of boredom and use them for something constructive and then still be able to use that as capital for your future career growth? And it seemed to me, I was using a bunch of Apache libraries back then, and I was just looking at their emails and how everyone could just go and do stuff and no one is going to send you back because you're working for free. And I thought, this feels like the way to go. You're getting visibility. Everyone can see and use your work. And I think that was resonating with me back then, the fact that your work is available for people to use. And that's when it became a certainty to me that, okay, this is the way to start. This is the way you accumulate human capital, human growth, human worth, and you prove your value without having to make the proverbial coffees for a bunch of years before someone gives you your shot. That's how it seemed to me back then, and that's how I got into open source. I still think that that's one of the main reasons open source works. It's because you remove a bunch of constraints to making your work available to people. It does the same thing with collaboration. Today, if you want two companies to collaborate, it is a very heavy process. You know, one of the ways is actually acquisitions, right? We want our two teams to work together. Let's just go through an acquisition. I would say this is probably one of the simplest ways, because once you acquire someone, there's no limits between the teams and they can fully collaborate. But you would know, like, the fastest acquisitions take months to complete. And we're talking about literally the simplest of the simplest would take 4 or 5 months for everything to, you know, for all the I's to be dotted and the T's to be crossed. And it's complicated. And if you want something a little bit more subtle than that, like, let's say Google and Microsoft have to collaborate. Oh man, this is just years of trying to agree on who owns what and what the procedure is to come up with new things. And this is before you even start writing a single line of code. And after you start, there's probably a bunch of procedures about what you can show, what you can talk about, what you cannot discuss. It's terrible. This is the huge advantage of open source. It creates this rally point of known terms that are well understood. Anyone can just come in. The licenses are well known to legal teams around the world, so they don't not anymore today get any substantial resistance. People are comfortable. You get collaboration efforts mounted very, very quickly. So yeah, to this day, I think that's why open source continues to work, contrary to the visions of the people who started the movement, who were envisioning the entire world running only on open source in some sort of egalitarian society. I used to believe that. I don't think that's what drives it. But getting to your question about, once you have an initiative, some sort of an activity, and it needs to grow, how do you make sure that it runs the way you want it to run? How do you run the engine? How do you run the team and all that? I think you're right that one of the first things that you have to look at is, well, what are you going to track? What are you going to look at? What is going to have your attention? I think we could spend days discussing this. So let's see what we can fit in a few minutes. Even the companies who do this the best still struggle with plenty of inconsistencies and inefficiencies. And I'm not saying this from a position of, I know how to do it. You know, you can, it's like one of those things you can, if you're trying to draw something, I don't know how to draw at all. And if I try to draw something, I can see it's ugly. That doesn't mean I know how to make it pretty. But let's talk a little bit about that. When you're creating something by yourself, it's very easy. You have only yourself to manage where you're going. You're only accountable to yourself, mainly. There's not much of a managerial problem. Although, still, I know that you're a runner. I run as well. Even running is just between you and yourself, right? It's between you and the road. And still, there's things that you have to do to make sure that you're going on down the right track. Let's say that you got into running for health reasons, right? You want to make sure that you're giving yourself the best possible chances for a longer health span and something like that. So you want to make sure that you're doing the right thing, right? So you want to observe that you're doing enough, that you're not doing too much, that you're doing it the right way. The metrics that you would choose are very important for that. So there's roughly two kinds of metrics. Ones that depend on what you do, and metrics that depend on the feedback that you get from reality, the results. The metrics that are linked to what you do are the easiest to deal with. That would be like, I decide that this week I will run 50 kilometers and I will keep running 50 kilometers. And I know, I'm confident that I'd be able to do it because I know how much free time I have. I know how much I run, and I can keep doing that week after week and be successful. That tells you nothing about what you're doing for your health. You're doing the 50 kilometers. Is that okay? Is that too much? Too little? Tells you nothing. On the other hand, what you want to track, for example, is if you want to see the impact that you're having on your health, you might look at simple things like, how's my weight? Am I still overweight? Am I getting back in shape? Or you can get a little bit more sophisticated and track things like, I'm tracking my VO2 max or my resting heart rate. And I love those, all of these actually, even just stepping on the scale every morning is like getting this check in with reality, and it says, this is how well we did, Emil. So you're 50 kilometers, not doing anything. It's not telling you whether you have to do more or less. It's telling you you're not being adequate right now. Same with VO2 max. For those who don't know, VO2 max is the amount of oxygen that you're capable of pumping through your body for a given unit of time. And that is linked with pretty good health in general and longevity and all of that. So being able to track that is very important. It tells you that you are, if it goes the right way, you know for sure that you're doing well. The problem is that it's very tricky to link it to what you do. Sometimes you would go and run 50 kilometers and at the end of the week you see, my watch is telling me that my VO2 max dropped. But why? It's like we've all had that moment. You wake up, you've had a day where you thought you did everything right and you step on the scale and it's 1 kilo up. It's like, what the heck? I did everything right, scale. What are you doing to me? And why? No, I should have been less. So there's plenty of these moments. It's very frustrating. It's very uncomfortable. And unfortunately, very often in corporate culture, we even have incentives to try and avoid metrics like that. Because imagine that your bonus at the end of the quarter is linked to what the scale says, right? Oh my God, this is uncomfortable because you don't fully control the scale. So your bonus is not fully under your control. So people try and run away from these reality feedbacks by, for example, no, I'd really like to make my metrics about what it is that I do. So the way that this translates in company culture is that rather than making your metrics about, ultimately the things that your product is supposed to be about, such as number of monthly active users, or ideally even how much money are you making? How many people are deciding every month that your product is worth it for them to keep paying your subscription or something like that? This is the best metric. This is why the company exists, is to provide value and get compensated for it, right? So if you can link your team's metrics to revenue, that's the best. The problem is that it's super uncomfortable, because there's all sorts of other things other than your work, other than your input that can impact this metric. There could be an economic crisis. I certainly don't want to lose my bonus if there's an economic crisis. On the contrary, I really need my bonus if there's an economic crisis. So people try to, even subconsciously, people try to run away from those. And I've seen this in many companies time and time again, where companies would go in quarterly business planning, and with the intention to go and create reality-based metrics. This is what OKRs are supposed to be about, right? That's the definitions of the OKR are all about reality feedback. But then the companies go in, they adopt fancy tools for tracking OKRs, and then the OKRs are ship 3 new features this quarter, which is exactly like run 10 kilometers this week. So what does that tell you about the value of your product to your customers? Nothing. Maybe these three features are going to be absolutely fantastic and everyone's going to love them, but more likely than not, it's something that you thought was nice, maybe easy to do, and it's not necessarily what the customer needed from you right now. So these I think are the challenges. What we track in the teams that I'm responsible for, we strive to always link whatever we do to user monthly active usage and revenue. We try, don't always succeed. And there's another difficult aspect here. Is imagine that you are the board of directors of a big company, right? And you hire a new CEO, and you talk with the CEO, and you agree, look, we think you should be able to give us 30% growth for this company over the next year. This is why we're hiring you. This is the reality. This is what we want reality to be in a year. Give us 30% growth. And let's say that you go with just that metric for the CEO, and the bonus of the CEO depends on that metric, and everything's linked to that. At the end of the year, let's say that the CEO hasn't hit the 30%. But do you go and fire the CEO? What if the 30% didn't happen because it really was a tough year? How do you know if this is a dependable CEO that really put his or her back into it, or whether they were just coasting around? This is where having agreed on something like, we'll ship three new products this year, is very convenient because, well, you know, we had a tough year and we didn't get the growth that we expected, but at least he did what he said he would do, or she. And it's that I feel that that's one of the reasons why not only the people who execute, the people who run a team or a company want to, you know, move toward metrics that they are able to drive, but this is why the people on the other side who they're accountable to are kind of willing to go with it, because, okay, I want to know at the end of the year whether I should be happy or unhappy with you. Did you do what you said you would do? And so it's a very complicated problem. But here's another issue that I think, gee, I've been talking for a lot. Feel free to interrupt me.
That's okay. I wanted to, yeah, I do have a question because, okay. You know, it's obviously, I think at least, you know, and I read your press release, which was like 2018, right? And when Jitsi was sold to 8x8, and it said, you know, we have our team intact and we're promised that the product is going to remain independent. And so basically, you know, it kind of, it sounded a lot like what we say, right? When we acquire a SaaS group, right? You do remain independent and we do try to cherish the people that you bring with you. But, you know, also let's be very kind of realistic and honest about this. No two processes in two companies are completely identical. So change is going to happen at some point, at some level. So, you know, kind of going into an acquisition thinking, oh, it's just going to be the same, right? Like, yes, the other person like signs the P&L for me, but nothing changes apart from this. And well, let's be honest, it's not true. So when you joined and you were coming from Atlassian, so maybe it's a bit more relevant to ask you like how it happened from the original Jitsi to, you know, with the move to Atlassian, right? So what kind of changes did you guys experience? Like you were a fully remote team, you were small, and they were Atlassian back then already. So, you know, kind of what was your journey there?
This episode is sponsored by Rewardful. Looking for new ways to find customers for your SaaS business? Consider building an affiliate program. Rewardful is the easiest affiliate tracking platform to set up, manage, and scale for SaaS companies. Building a successful affiliate program can be a little bit intimidating at first, and that's why Rewardful has taken what they've observed from their most successful customers' affiliate programs and distilled that into an exclusive online course. The exciting part? Their affiliate marketing course is absolutely free. Start the course at academy.rewardful.com. Academy.rewardful.com. And turn your biggest fans into your best marketers.
Oh man, that was extremely stressful. It was so, we wanted this merger, this acquisition, merger, you know, it's funny. They were 1,500, we were 15. So let's call it a merger to stroke my ego. So we wanted this acquisition to happen. It wasn't something that happened against our will, like you would sometimes read such and such factory got acquired and no one from the workers wanted. Everyone was excited about this. Atlassian is a great place to work. It had and it still has a great reputation. So everything was looking right. And still, this was such a tremendous culture shock. And there were so many conflicts that arose unexpectedly. And I think they had to do with, first of all, I was completely inexperienced in any of that. I was, again, we were coming from this hippie place that wasn't even, you wouldn't even call it a startup by American standards. It was this bootstrap thingy that, you know, did a number of things, many of which stupid. And we're going to this well-oiled, well-organized machine that was Atlassian that was just delivering for its customers quarter after quarter. And when the two things clashed, it was very painful. I don't know whether it's possible to avoid that pain because you need a substantial amount of perspective change that I don't know whether you could get without some amount of stress. A few of the things that happened was that when you plug into an organization, you need contact points for the rest of the organization that you didn't need before. Back when you were a small company, maybe you had the guy who talked to the customers. I keep saying these things, guy. Let's say that I'm using guy as a gender neutral noun. So you had you have the person who would talk to customers, and you have the person who deals with the money, maybe. And in many cases, this is just the founder and the CEO. You have some division of responsibilities that no longer works in the bigger company. You don't necessarily deal with customers when you're in the bigger company, but let's say that you have your reliability engineering team, and then you have your marketing team, and then you have the product management for the entire group that wants to commit to a number of things that would happen and a number of ways that things are going to happen. So we, for example, all this to say that we started needing things like someone needs to be product manager, not necessarily only because we think that's the best way to run your team, but someone needs to be accountable for the product decisions that are being made and be able to interface with the rest of the organization. Creating that role is not easy because it didn't exist before. It was kind of distributed. And I suspect that's the way with many companies. Well, I'm kind of responsible for that part of the product because I know it the best and it's my thingy. And then you're responsible for that part of the product. That doesn't work in a big organization. Every person who needs to know that your group is going to deliver such and such result, they need to talk to one person, not, oh, this is Jeremy. And oh, you wanted this menu? Then that's Amanda over there. That doesn't work. So the same goes for, in Atlassian, they were following a pretty conventional model. So there was a product manager, an engineering manager, and a designer. Having to having to choose who's going to be what was one of the things that introduced stress, because everyone was thinking, gee, so now I'm going to be boxed into this new role. There's maybe a few things that I don't really want to do that I'm going to have to do, but that's not the bigger problem. The bigger problem is that I was opinionated on a bunch of other things outside of my domain, and they're no longer going to be my responsibility. And this is scary. I remember, for example, that back then I considered myself a technical person. And so I kind of wanted to be engineering manager or something like that. I didn't really understand the purpose of a product manager. Now I that's what I do. I do product. It took me a few years to realize that I just have to give up my technological pretenses. But this meant that when the actual product manager came in the team, we kept butting heads because I had a bunch of opinions about the way that the product should go. And it was not my job. He was accountable for, like, he would go on conversations with the rest of the organization. He would commit to certain things. And I would say, no, we shouldn't be doing it that way. And we know, all complacent. And I know best. And Emil's know best. So we're not going to do it that way, Joe. That's sorry you agreed with other people like that, but it's not happening. And this led to a bunch of things. And there were the hierarchies that are necessary within the company. Yeah, for the same reason, you need accountability. And then someone in a team that was in a small company, pretty much egalitarian, someone has to bubble up and on top of other people. And some of those other people, hey, I thought I was going to be that guy. What are you doing in that role? And that leads to conflict as well. And I don't think you can hope to avoid that stress completely. That's just not going to happen. The only way this happens is if you have two big organizations merging and the structure is already in place. And nothing really changed. That's not a real acquisition. That's some sort of a, you know how big mergers are. It's not the same at all as when you're acquiring a startup. So the only thing you can do, I believe, is to try and explain as much as possible everything that we just said right now. Here's the reason we need this. And maybe you even do it before you sign the deal, just so that people feel that, okay, I signed up for this. I knew this was coming. It's not thrust onto me. The reason it's usually not discussed in advance when you acquire a company is because the acquiring company doesn't realize that this is going to be a change for the people that they're going to acquire. So, oh, but, you know, of course this is going, what did you think was going to happen? Like, of course we have to fit you into our hierarchy. So yeah, I think the best way is to try and provide empathy to the employees in the company. Here's why we need this. We cannot deal with a conversation with five different people every time we need to make a decision. We need someone to be accountable in that role, in an engineering role, in a design role. So we need to select these people. We need you to, because we budgets work this way, we need you to commit to this and this and this. We need you to do this and this work. And try and explain the reasons I think would make the process easier, but it's never going to be a walk in the park. What is your impression? Don't you, do you kind of get this?
Absolutely. Oh my God. I mean, even like on a personal level, I was not acquired with other company. I just joined SaaS Group, but I joined from, like you said, like the startup-y, scrappy place where, you know, we were four. Right. And I fought tooth and nail to like not have to like put everything in a certain folder and like do the processes and, you know, go through certain things. And only then I realized that, okay, this is probably what entire teams go through. Like sometimes we acquire companies when, yeah, there are some processes, but mostly, you know, oh, it's in my head. I know this client, like he's been with us for 8 years. I know his phone by heart. And yeah, having to put it into a CRM, like that's just stupid. So yeah, I think for us, obviously we're not an old company. We just celebrated what, like 7 years. And you know, the first two or three were just like a couple of acquisitions, right? And there were no processes in place back then. So I think we've been constantly learning. And even since like I joined, right, it's been this stupidly steep learning curve when sometimes even the founders would say, okay, well, like you said, they are coming into a certain hierarchy, right? Even if the companies are independent, even if we're just adding kind of like this one person, not even on top of them, not even making decisions for them or telling them what to do, but he or she is still there, right? It still helps in our experience to kind of visualize it and say, hey, you know, there is this person. It's like an added person to kind of your team, to kind of like peek sometimes from behind the scenes to see what you guys are doing. So yeah, I think just coming into an acquisition expecting no change, it's pretty naive. But yeah, but again, you know, that's another story that we are preaching. You can absolutely pick and choose your acquirers so that, you know, that transition and that change is just a little bit easier, so it's not like as holy and stuff.
Absolutely. And then if we have to give some sort of advice to people that are going to go through acquisitions, I think the best that you can do when you're trying to evaluate an acquirer is to just try and learn as much as you can about their previous acquisitions. Not necessarily to try and get them for aha. You know, you say you're not going to do this, but look at what happened with that previous company. But to at least see, okay, what did people struggle with in the previous acquisitions? Do I think I'm going to struggle with that? I do. So, well, let's talk about it. How are we going to handle this? Because I think you had this problem with the other company. I think you're going to have it with us as well. What are we going to do? This is the only way to go through this. You're never going to find an acquirer where the merger is just going to be seamless and you're not going to feel any discomfort. That's just not happening. The best that you can do is try to prepare for the discomfort as much as you can so that it's not a huge surprise, so that you know what sort of work you're going to have to do. And ultimately, if you think that this is really, really incompatible with what you're looking for, then fine, find someone else. But keep in mind, no one is going to be perfect. So.
Yeah, that's great. So I know we kind of took a backwards approach to this, but you know, since we started talking about an acquisition, and yeah, I wanted to ask you, like, how you ended up with Atlassian, like, right? You got the email, and probably, you know, for beginner startup, it sounds amazing. Atlassian noticed me, and I'm probably going to get my TechCrunch article and, you know, tell all my friends that I made it. But why at the end of the day you thought it was a fit? It was such a huge company already back then.
So by the time we heard from Atlassian, we had had a couple of other offers for acquisitions that we had rejected. And so this wasn't immediately, okay, here it is. Finally, it's happening. It was exciting because Atlassian had a great reputation. And the more we read about it, the more everyone was writing about what a great place to work this was. And felt like it felt nice to be noticed by a reputable name, but by no means did we immediately assume that this is it. You know, we're finally doing it. So what it did was it kickstarted a process of negotiation that lasted a few months. It was a very funny process. So the first thing that happened was that they asked us to name our price. And I would have an advice that you could cut out from this interview if you want. But my advice for companies being acquired is don't name your price. Don't start by doing this. First of all, because there's nothing to win. Your acquirer has likely, if they're in a position to acquire you, then they've probably been doing that for a while. So they probably know a lot better what the market is and what they are willing to spend. Let them do the first offer. We kind of went for it and we named the figure. And then they came back the next day and then they said, okay. And we were like, wait, what? And then we started thinking about it. And then we thought, actually, this doesn't feel like it was the right number. We started looking at what did other companies go for similarly and said, oh, this really doesn't feel like the right number. But except that at this point, it felt horrible to just go and say, actually, no, you know, we want three times as much. I remember Jana and I and the team, we had a discussion about this and we all thought, okay, maybe we screwed that up. Lesson learned. We're not going to do it again. But we're just going to tell them that, sorry, we didn't really mean this and we realize it's a shitty thing to do. But so if you walk away, that we accept that, we get it. But we think that that's not the right number. Now, they were very gracious and they said, well, let us think about it and we'll come back to you and then you can tell us. So they came back with a number that was three times higher. And they said, what do you think about that? And at that point, we accepted it and it felt, well, there were so many other things. One of the things that we kept hearing from them, we had a very experienced M&A guy that was Rowan Savage. He wrote a book about M&A acquisitions and he was really, he's Irish. I remember every time we would get on these long hour calls and he would say with his Irish accent, all right, Emo. And then we would go into these long, tiresome conversations. They kept repeating, look, we want you for what you do. So even though many things are going to change, ultimately we would want you to remain and keep producing the sort of stuff that you're producing because that's why we're acquiring you. So this was really helpful, but it still conflicted with the procedural legal side of an acquisition can be very scary as well. When you get to signing a contract for an acquisition, there's a number of things in that contract that don't feel right to you. Things like there's a bunch of edge cases that are being discussed where things are said like, let's say if you were to commit a felony and you find yourself in jail, you know, the whole deal is off and we're not responsible. And so that's not something you would have even thought about. So what? That doesn't even cross your mind. But then when you see written in a contract and you start thinking, well, what if something like this happens accidentally? So not only am I going to have, you know, some legal calamity happen in my life, but on top of that, this entire thing falls apart. And what, would I have to give money back? What am I going to get this money? And you start obsessing over scenarios that you consider that still are extremely unlikely, but they kind of become the center of the conversation. Now, what made things worse in our case is that, and I think that happens, there was this movie with Scarlett Johansson and Adam Driver. I forget what it was called, but it was about them going through a divorce. And it started with both parties being very amicable and let's just get it done. And, you know, we still respect each other, but let's just go through this without much conversation. Then their lawyers started bringing up the edge cases to them. And
Mary's story.
Yes, that's the one. Yes. And it ended up being a major conflict and it escalated so badly. And this is what happened to us as well. We hired a French firm. Ultimately, I'm not going to name them because we're not happy at all with them. They ended up charging us like five times more than what they had promised. And they were doing that a lot. They were experienced lawyers. They were good lawyers. But the way what they were lacking was the empathy of this common shared perspective of what it is that we're doing. Look, we don't want to argue over trivialities that are not going to change. Like there's a bunch of, when Atlassian was not a public company back then, but it still had investors. It had a certain number of things that it just couldn't afford to not put into a contract, like the felony thing, right? You might feel that this is out of place and why are we even putting it in here? They cannot afford to not have it because then the lawyer who didn't put it in the contract is going to be accountable to the shareholders of why wasn't that there? So that's not going to happen and you need to accept it. Normally you would rely on your legal advisor to give you that reassurance. Just don't worry about that. You know, that's something they have to do. Yes, on the off chance that it happens, you will be screwed, but I don't advise you to obsess over that. We had exactly the opposite. Oh, no. You can't allow for this to go into the contract. And they feel that, and I don't know why lawyers end up in that situation, but they feel that they have to be the warrior there for you. They kind of, you know, how we imagine the White House meetings of the boss of the Defense Department would always go and say, yeah, we have to go to war. That's how many lawyers end up being. And ultimately, this just ended up costing us a lot of stress, a lot of money. And, you know, in the case of Atlassian, where, as it was proven by time, we had a good, willing acquirer. If I were able to talk to my past self and to Yana's past self, I would have said, just don't get lawyers. That's just going to be wasted money, wasted nerves, wasted effort. This is true for our case. I don't think I want to just tell everyone, hey, you don't need lawyers for acquisitions. I'm sure that there's plenty of scam happening in the world on these things. But what I want to do is I want it to be known to people that having a combative legal position is not always in your favor. And it can cost you way more than it saves you. You have to be very careful to hit a middle ground. You have to be mindful that lawyers are incentivized to push toward conflict. And it is your role to push back against this. To all these acquirees who are scared of signing these contracts, just keep in mind that that's normal. Doesn't mean that all of these things are going to happen. Don't be too scared about it and try to find a reasonable middle ground.
I think that's so important. I mean, even on our website, and I think like I've been thinking about it for a bit. It says no lawyers, right? No lawyers, you're going to be involved. And again, to be honest, the last quite a few acquisitions, there were always lawyers, right? And maybe it's because we mostly have been acquiring in Germany. Like in Germany, there is lawyer for your lawyer and for his lawyer. But true, right? So, it's also because, well, yeah, there are things that your acquirer wants to steer clear, and you clearly also want some protection from. So I think these days, maybe it's not that realistic to just say, hey, like no lawyers are involved. So possibly I'm going to change that on our website too. I think you're right. Like, again, getting somebody, I think we talked quite a bit about that. Like getting someone who has been working with similar acquisitions, similar sizes of companies, as a lawyer, as an M&A lawyer, is important. And then you also have to do your due diligence on them because, like you said, it's a bit of a battle. Like, there is a bit of a haggling. There is a bit of conflict always because, hey, there are like some skeletons that you forgot about. And yeah, just having kind of someone empathetic. I love the word that you used. Empathetic, who knows what you're going through, is so important.
Yes, it is. And it's also, it's the same thing goes for you. You have to be empathetic toward your acquirer as well. And you have to understand that they have constraints that they just cannot go around. Yeah. And one way that you could possibly do this is maybe look for an individual lawyer that you're hiring more of an advisor rather than to be your negotiator. I remember Jana and I had this opportunity to go to the HEC business school in Paris. And there was this tremendous legal professor there. Karim Majad was his name. And he was an anarchist jurist. He was just so cynical. He was saying, you know, just because someone signs a contract that says that they're going to commit harakiri doesn't mean that they're going to go and commit harakiri. He was very cynical about these things. But one of the things he taught us was a contract isn't supposed to be about all the complicated legal language in there. A contract isn't going to save you from any bad realities, because again, people aren't going to commit harakiri just because it's said so in the fine print. The contract is supposed to be there for parties who are willing and genuinely intentional to do work together to kind of agree what it is that they're actually doing. And you should be able to write your own contract, and you shouldn't feel like this is something outside of your field of expertise. Now, with some of these acquisition contracts, the language is so complicated that you do need someone who kind of understands the formulation to walk you through it. But keep in mind that you're not hiring a negotiator. You're not hiring someone who's going to give you the deal that you want. Think of it as a ChatGPT. In fact, I don't know, that might actually be helpful these days. Just use ChatGPT.
Do not recommend people to have acquisition contract written by ChatGPT.
You only live once. But think of them that way. They're your assistant. Yeah. They're providing you an interpretation. Do not try and evade your responsibility. The decisions are going to have to be yours, regardless of what the lawyer says. It's still you signing the document. So trust your own evaluation the most.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, kind of going backwards, I wanted to ask you about, you know, selling the company from the point of view of selling an open source project. And we do have, quite a few, I think, articles on our website too, and one going like deeply into the tech DD of open source projects for an acquisition. How was it for you? Like, how did it maybe change the process? Were there any like peculiar things because you guys were open source? And what was the company's perspective if maybe you were discussing it with Atlassian or somebody like an advisor? What were their concerns regarding acquiring open source?
Yeah, this is super interesting. There were some concerns that manifested prior to acquisition, and then there were concerns that manifested post-acquisition. Let's talk about both of them. Pre-acquisition, open source simplifies things tremendously because your work is out there, and it is very likely that the acquirer went and looked through it before they even talked to you. Everything is available, so there's unlikely to be many skeletons in the closet, if any, because it's all out there. Tools for evaluating, copyright infringement and things like that can be just run off of your GitHub repos again before you even start the acquisition. So everything is very streamlined that way. Another thing that you have to consider pre-acquisition is how things are going to play out with the community. Now, this is less often a problem than one would expect. So you would think that in a community where a bunch of people contribute for free, some smaller core of these people getting compensated for all the work would rub people the wrong way. The reality is that in most open source projects, you don't have a significant number of contributions coming from outside that core. Most likely, most of your code came from the core people. Sure, you got help from others, but you know their contribution is still out there. You're not really taking anything from them. This gets us also into the reason of why would you want to even acquire an open source company? Because you cannot, one thing that people sometimes get wrong about the acquisition of open source projects is just because someone acquires an open source project doesn't mean that they have the ability to somehow make it non-open source all of a sudden. Now they can continue developing that project in a closed manner from the point of acquisition forward, but whatever has been released open source once can never be unreleased, right? As long as you got your copy with the license that it was distributed, that license is perpetual. It's still out there. So you cannot, whatever contribution was made remains outside. The reason you would still go and acquire an open source project is primarily because the people that you're going to end up acquiring, the people that are going to end up working for you, that's your reason. You want to be able to to provide the incentive for these people to have a say in the direction that the project takes, to make it potentially more compatible with your other projects or something like that. And if the rest of the community feels like that's not a direction they want to go in, a fork is always an option. So I would say there's some amount of suspiciousness always that's going to be voiced in these communities, but ultimately that is rarely a huge problem. Once you get acquired, some things are likely to change. Smaller companies are less careful about every single aspect of an open source project. For example, I remember that at Atlassian, they felt uncomfortable with the licenses that we were using originally. So we ended up continuing the development under the Apache license because it was better understood and easier to handle for legal teams. Another thing that we had to do was make it mandatory for people to sign. If you wanted to contribute something to the project from now on, you had to sign a contributor agreement that would protect the company against unpleasant surprises. Like what people don't want, what big companies are worried about, is you come in with an open source project and then someone out there comes and says, oh, here, take my pull request here, take my fix. I'm adding this nice little feature. In the mind of the big company, what can happen, I don't know how often this has actually happened, but what people obsess about is, what if this person comes back 3 months from now and says, I actually have a patent on what I gave you, and I haven't given you the right to use my patent, and now I want you to pay me that much money for that patent. So again, I don't know how realistic that is, but it certainly is a theoretical possibility. That's what these companies want to protect against when they have you sign a contributor agreement. So I feel that most people don't really have an issue with that. Again, there's some suspiciousness voiced, but ultimately it's not a huge problem. What ends up being really, for us, what ended up being an issue, that was very funny. Atlassian didn't have any major open source projects before we went and joined them. And one of the things that they were very uncomfortable with was providing stuff to the competition for free. They were really neck and neck on the HipChat front back in those days. They were really in the neck and neck competition with Slack. And Slack had also made a video acquisition, but the Jitsi one was substantially more sophisticated and evolved. So Atlassian felt, rightfully so, that they had scored a major point by getting the better video team. And soon people started saying, but wait a second, so we got the better video team, but everything they do now is free and Slack can just take it. What people didn't realize is that adopting an open source project is, you know, has a lot more constraints than the code being available. Now, in Atlassian's defense, I would say that Atlassian was a company that had, up until that point, this was 2015, 2016, that's when they were transitioning to the cloud. So everything up until that moment wasn't subscriptions. The money they were making wasn't made from subscriptions that they're getting from people. It was licenses for handing them the code, right? So to them, giving someone the code was their bread and butter, right? So that's what has them survive. That's what gets them revenue. And if you all of a sudden come and say, oh, I'm just going to hand out the code for free, it feels very uncomfortable to them. And we had multiple tense situations, because we would go and do something and release it in open source, and it would be available in our open source repositories, but it would still not be deployed in the Atlassian services. So mean to say that the stuff that you just did, we're giving it out for free to everyone, but our paying customers are not getting it, which sounds like a legitimate question. And it is a legitimate question. You have to go through a lot of explanations as to why you shouldn't worry about this. One of the things that we came up with that we felt was a good way to explain it is, look, when you're developing an open source project, it's like leading a peloton in bike racing. You are first. Now, a bunch of people can choose to get behind you and draft behind you, and they use the fact that you've eliminated some of the friction, and they're getting you doing work for them for free. But in order for them to get that work for free, they have to be behind you. And it's the same in open source. Someone may go and choose to adopt your open source project. Let's say that Slack can come out and say, we want to get the work that Atlassian is doing for free. Now, the work is going to, let's say that some feature is being developed. Let's say that you start developing in January. You think about how this is going to be incorporated in Atlassian projects. You have made the design so that it fits the Atlassian project. You release it in April. And you have, let's say, a few more weeks before it hits the actual Atlassian project. But this is when Slack sees it for the first time. This is when they get to start thinking, how are we going to make available this to our users? And we need to change our products a little bit in order to accommodate that. This is in a hypothetical universe where Slack actually cares about this. And so they have multiple months of work before they're able to leverage that feature, which is, yes, they're going to eventually get the work for free, but they're always going to be behind, exactly like in drafting with bicycles. So that was a common point of contention. And it's funny because when we went to 8x8, which is a telco, people often associate telcos with, more rigor, less flexibility. 8x8 didn't have these concerns at all. Like, no one ever at 8x8 was worried about, are other people going to get this for free? And I think the reason is because 8x8 has always been a service provider. 8x8 never sold code to people. It was always a service that they were providing. And the code had never been seen as the value that you're handing to users in order to get money. So it came very natural to them. Sure. I mean, this is open source, of course. No, what really matters is what we're offering to our customers through our service. So that's funny. Now, obviously, 8x8 is also a very forward-thinking company, and maybe that probably played a role as well. But I find it funny how, on this specific aspect, Atlassian was much more uncomfortable than 8x8.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And then, again, when you say they're getting the product for free, just given everything that you said about, working for a month on it, free is a very subjective matter in this case.
Yes, it is. And all the things that they're not getting about, I need to embed this, but I'd like you to make this little change here so that it's easier for us to embed it. Whoever it is that employs the team that does the changes is obviously going to be in a much more privileged position than someone who's just drafting and just using what they get. So there's a bunch of advantages that come with funding an open source project.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think when you are making early acquisitions, again, to the point that you said earlier, it's a lot about the team and not really about what you coded. So I know we have a hard stop in 15 minutes. That's why I'm going to get to a couple questions that I usually ask here, right? And given, and I was fascinated by, the story that you told at the beginning about the walkie-talkie and everything. And I was like, man, you've been kind of into this your entire life. And you know how there is this cheesy saying like make your hobby your work and you will never work a day in your life. And, you know, I honestly think it's a bit of a bullshit, but in your case, it's actually working. So I want to ask you about, you know, over this journey, the biggest win and the biggest failure. And, you know, it can be anything that pops into your mind. Maybe that Tesla that has a Jitsi license plate that you bought after an acquisition. Anything that really kind of stuck to you.
This is interesting, as there's certainly no regrets for anything that we've done. There's a few big wins. So let's start with do a job you love and you will never work a day in your life. I know what you mean when you say I feel this is a little bit of a BS, because truly, even when you do your hobby, you still often have to do things that you don't want to do. You know, running, for example. I have a friend that says when he talks about loving running, he says, "Oh, I love having run, but I hate every second of it while I'm doing it."
Exactly, that's so good.
You could, you know, head tip to Brian Bodino here, but so. When you're out there doing intervals and you're just waiting for that interval to end and you're just counting the seconds, you hate that part. Does that mean that you didn't work just because in general you like running? And it's the same with a job that you like. Even if it's open source, you still have to deal with paying your taxes at the end of the year. You still have to write bureaucratic stuff. You still have to implement features that are not sexy but necessary, or you have to go and improve your logging one day and maybe you just wanted to work on a new sexy thing with AI, but you're stuck with improving your logging. And so there's plenty of that. But let's say that the way that I interpret that saying is that at least you don't have some deep sense of something going wrong. You don't hate your life for doing what you do. And I'll go back to what I said about my early years during my PhD in academia. There was nothing that I particularly hated about my job. I was choosing whatever it is that I was doing. I was picking my subjects. I was deciding my hours. And I still felt a deep sense of gloom. It wasn't nice. I felt that things weren't right. I think that's what this is about, trying to find a job that fits with your life in multiple ways. You know, one of the things, for example, that I've been particularly lucky about is that we work, Jana and I, on this together. Now, funny enough, my dad and my mom, they used to work together. My mom passed away 15 years ago, but they had an architectural company. They worked together, and maybe I got a good glimpse of that, and that's why I ended up in the same situation. But working on the same project with your life partner, I think gives you a sense of fulfillment that is also very significant. There's, you know, people think, oh, I don't know, do I really want to take my work problems home? And I think it's exactly the opposite. When you work with your partner and you get so much empathy for free, I would say, without having to explain, you know, I don't have to say, hey, I'm preparing for this very important meeting that happens once a quarter. And it's with the CEO, and the CEO has been a little edgy lately because of this and that. And I have to make sure there's a bunch of explanations that you have to do in order to bring up, you know, bring everyone up to speed. When you're working together, you just say, I have a meeting with Sam tomorrow, so I need a few minutes, and that's it. And there's also some shared sense of pride, and you both build a thing, you have one more child. So I think that's one of my main successes, that we really got that part right, being able to work on it as a team and as a family. I hope this isn't starting to sound too cheesy, but I heard there was this demographic expert that was talking about our society has changed a lot in the past 60, 70 years. And people are, you know, discovering that there are all these conflicts about, well, how do you, you know, it used to be that men would do some kinds of jobs and women would do other kinds of jobs, and we had it all figured out, and then they would meet in certain cases and create families. And then, well, everyone's in the same place But we still have to make families. And then there's all this misunderstanding happening and people having unwanted advances without some, you know, necessarily guy A wants to talk to girl B and guy A really likes her, but girl B is really not into him. But he went and he asked her and then this created this malaise. And she, oh my God, what are we going to do about this? This is such a, you know, HR teams would usually go and say, oh, this is off. No, we're not going to do that at all because we don't want the all the messiness that comes with it. Yeah, but these people spend their lives at work. Like, so what are you going to do? They're not going to have any human interactions. That's not going to work out. And there's all this messiness there. And this demographic expert was saying, he too was working with his wife. They were writing books together. And he said, there's something in that. There's something in that model that actually fits really nicely with the modern world where a family just get to work on the same thing. And so many things are just solved nicely with that. So yes, I feel that's a big success. Now,
it's great. No, I just to comment on that, I think you're absolutely right. Well, you know, when they say you have to, you do, like you said, you don't have to bring work home, right? But especially now, like we work from home, right? So right, work right, is home. Right. This is impossible. And even, yes, you know, even before when we went to the office, you still want to go and like you want to say that, you know, what happened and like what project I'm working with. And, you know, I'm talking to Emil and, you know, who the hell is Emil? And, you know, I kind of want this person that I partner with to know who I'm talking to, why I'm talking to you and all that stuff. So yes, 100 times yes, I totally back you up on this. Working with your partner, spouse, whoever, is a game changer.
Yeah. All right, great.
All right, I'm back to you, sorry.
Very glad you're hearing that. Yeah, I think that that people should pay more attention to that possibility. And yeah, the best way, I mean, you could do that by just ending up working at the same place. But then what happens if one of you gets an offer for a better place or if one of you, you know, gets in the layoffs and the other doesn't? So just creating something of your own is a good way to go down that path as well. Just sort of a family business is what you would call it. And now not everything is possible that way. And you know, people have to make their own choices. But I feel that's a good road to explore and think about.
Absolutely. You said no regrets, right? But maybe again, a failure or maybe just a learning that you really remember.
Well, we certainly did plenty of mistakes. Again, we implemented plenty of things that were wrong. Back in the early days, I didn't realize it, but we were just so dead focused on creating an application that runs on your computer, and we should have created... That's not very friendly to users. People didn't even understand. Like we would go and say, when people ask us, what are you doing? I would say, well, we're playing, working on a multi-protocol communicator that no one even understood what we're doing. We should have went and created just a communication service and just called it something and says, oh, this is something that lets you chat and talk over the internet. But then it has to actually do that without requiring you to have a PhD in order to configure the damn thing. And we certainly were in that position. It was super complicated to configure the thing that we were doing. And again, the lack of empathy toward the problems that Atlassian had while they were integrating us. I wish I had been more mature during these days. But all of these things, it's silly to regret them because you can never know everything. And one of the reasons that the Phoenix trope is so popular is because everyone needs to be able to understand that sometimes you're going to have to burn yourself to the ground and change very substantially the things that you're doing in order to be more fit for the environment. And we've been able to do that. Jitsi has changed multiple times. It has become a different thing. On the downside, it's something currently that requires 10 minutes to define when you started. It's a project, but collection of projects, but APIs and all of that. I feel that we've kind of done well, and the mistakes have just been opportunities to learn how to do better.
Yeah, but going back to the introduction and kind of explaining what Jitsi is it something that you thought it will be, or is it a completely different thing?
I would answer this the following way. The way that it looks is nowhere near what I thought it would look. but it feels like the thing that was making me happy when I was talking over the walkie-talkie, it's still there. I'm still happy that I can get in a conversation with people, get a bunch of fancy things happening during that conversation. Those fancy things used to be, I'm able to send you a picture 20 years ago. And today it is, I'm able to get help from ChatGPT about what to say next. The fancy things themselves change, but the thing that was creating the passion that I had for implementing communication over internet, that is still there. So in that sense, yes, it still is what I wanted it to be.
All right. I think it's we can easily add this to the win. And now I started thinking when you said you can get ChatGPT tell you what to say next. I had a founder on this podcast, and after we finished, he was like, yeah, all this time I had this other tool running during the podcast that was actually suggesting me like how to pace the conversation and, you know, how to, what to potentially say next. And I just like, I was holding my breath all this time because I thought, oh my God, if he was just talking about what ChatGPT told him to talk about, that is just horrible. But no, then he said it was just an experiment. But now I think it might have been Jitsi. What do you think?
I hope so. I certainly hope so. I don't know, but this is, you know, this is such a fascinating topic. We're going to have to maybe schedule another session for that one, but just the way
yes,
that
please.
You would integrate LLMs into conversation sessions is just so fascinating. And we're at the beginning of it. No one really knows where this is going to end up going. There's plenty to say about what LLMs are good for doing and what they're not and how they mix with humans. Exactly. I'm very excited about the possibilities there. I think they are removing a lot of rough edges from work that people were doing. I think they remove a lot of unpleasant stuff that you can now get done with the help of LLMs. I think certain people are overestimating what LLMs can do. The idea that autonomous LLM-driven agents, for example, would play a huge role, I don't really buy that. Maybe some corner cases here and there, but I don't think that they excel when put in a role of responsibility. I think they excel when they're assisting a human to do things faster, to spare the human some of the automatic work. I think that's a fantastic way to get them. And one of these ways is, I mean, when that person was talking to you, you know, the agent could have realistically reminded them that, hey, don't forget you wanted to talk about this thing. And when you said something, maybe the agent could have said, oh, by the way, you discussed that topic with that other guy. Do you want to talk, raise this same point again? There's a bunch of ways in which the agent can assist you to be a better version of yourself rather than making you become the skin for a robot. So I'm very excited about the possibilities there.
Absolutely. That's a great point. And, you know, I'm all for scheduling another session. But if you have two more minutes, I'm going to ask the last question that's always here on the podcast. And it's about a hack. And it can be, again, it can be anything, you know, something that helps you feel excited about this journey for so many years or helps you run bigger teams, helps you adopt a new kind of role within the bigger team, or something that's super like technical or growth related. So anything that worked, a bit of magic.
Okay. I do have something. It's I don't know how, it's a perspective on things. And I think it's important for people to keep it in mind. I had this thought when I was reading Seven Eves from Neal Stephenson. It was about, he was explaining orbital mechanics and Lagrange points. Lagrange points, to those who haven't heard the term, is when you have two bodies in space and they both have their gravitational fields around them, their orbits, and they cross in certain places. There are certain spots called Lagrange points where a body is experiencing substantial levels of pull from both of these celestial bodies. And so let's say that you have a spaceship that is on an earthly orbit, and then there's the moon around it. which also has a gravity pool. So when the ship comes at a specific point where it's right in between the moon and Earth, that ship could very easily switch from an Earth orbit to a lunar orbit with just a little burn of fuel. Now, in pretty much every other place, in order for ship to get to the moon, it has to burn a bunch of fuel to get out of the earthly orbit and then burn some more fuel in order to get to the moon, and then finally it will have arrived. But the spend of fuel, the difference in spend would be tremendous. Now, I feel that this sort of analogy applies a ton to software teams. What happens very often, this happens a lot in product management, it happens a lot in just running companies. Someone usually far removed from engineering teams, but it can even happen to the product manager who works with the team and who just lacks the empathy or the understanding of the work that the team is doing. That person can come and rationalize that it would be great for this product to work this way and to offer this functionality to people. That would be fantastic. Let's say that would be 100% perfect. It is very likely that achieving the 100% perfect solution would have a prohibitive cost. If you want the product to work that way, we have to completely redo the way we use the database. We have to completely redo some of our backend services and switch them from this model to that model. It would be very expensive. I don't care. That's the 100% perfect product. We have to deliver it. It is often the case that there's a 95% perfect product that would be almost equivalent to the end user, or maybe to a slightly different set of users, that happens to be exactly on our orbital path. It takes a little change on that service, a little change in middleware there, and bam, we have it with 1/10 of the cost, and we can do it right away. And the other thing that you wanted, the 100% project, maybe it's not even a matter of it not being available, but if you just wait for 3 months, there's this other project there that would release a new version and we'd be able to do it likely at that point, and then we'd be able to do it with just a bit of a burn. This is the sort of thing that often becomes a problem, especially in environments that require a lot of planning, when people want to commit to huge roadmaps, and where the orbits of individual engineers are very complicated to track, or people just don't have the empathy to look into them. So I have found through my career that trying to keep track of every engineer's orbit, trying to understand what it is that they're currently working on, what it is that they currently want to work on, and trying to figure out, okay, what planets are in that vicinity that might be of interest to us? This, I feel, is a great secret to delivering value for customers, because you're working with what you have rather than what you wish you had. So I would encourage everyone to try and understand as much as possible what their teams are excited about and what they're doing currently, so that they would be able to better deliver value for their customers.
That's amazing. Loved it. I'm pretty sure if I shared with our product team, they're going to love it too. But I'll give you the feedback when I do that. But thank you so much for the conversation. I mean, honestly, I think this is kind of this is the longest episode ever. Second, it's probably the one where I talk the least ever. So it was really fascinating to listen. No, it's great. Happy to do it again sometime, anytime. And thank you so much for being here.
It would be my pleasure, and it was my pleasure, Anna. Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure chatting with you, and let's try to do next time as more of a discussion.
Sure, of course. And
have
take
a
care.
Wonderful day.
That was yet another awesome conversation on SaaS Unbound. We're always looking for new guests to share their experiences. We mostly talk with bootstrapped SaaS founders, and if you're one, reach out to me directly at anna@saas.group or find me on LinkedIn. If you're not bootstrapped or even not SaaS but have a great story to tell, we want to hear from you too. And obviously, SaaS Unbound wouldn't be possible without the SaaS Group, a founder-friendly private equity company that buys awesome businesses that people love to take them to even greater success.
If you're thinking about selling your company or just exploring your options, feel free to visit saas.group, fill in the form, and expect a response in under 24 hours.